Good afternoon and welcome to Soundbites for January 21st, 1990. I'm Bob Smith, and during this particular edition of the program, we have for you first up, one of our most popular commentators, Nick Francesco, is going to be with us and taking your telephone calls at 263-WXXI, where we'll be talking about a variety of topics, current developments in the computer world, and how they affect you. Then in the second portion of the program, Paul Casarino will be with us to talk about the second portion of our utilities program series. We'll be talking about the Xtree family of programs to help you find and access data on your hard disk drive more efficiently. Then, of course, we'll be hearing from Dan Ruby, commentator on the world of the Macintosh. He, of course, the editor of Mac Week magazine, and he'll have some brand new information in store for you on new product introductions and the developments in the Apple world. All that coming up on Soundbites following the latest in computer news. Final arguments are set for tomorrow in the computer virus trial of Cornell University graduate student Robert Morris in Syracuse. Correspondent Ellen Abbott told Soundbites that the centerpiece of the defense was displayed Thursday when Morris himself took the stand.
Well, the defense really came down to the testimony of Morris himself. He was on the stand all of Thursday, and basically it came down to him saying he did not intend for the worm to cause a lot of damage, that it was simply an experiment that went awry, that he never intended for it to do what it did back in November of 1988.
Jurors must now decide if the virus, which slowed down a national defense and research network, was a deliberate attempt at sabotage or just a legitimate experiment which went radically wrong. They are expected to receive the judge's charge and begin deliberations on Tuesday. U.S. Memories, the much-touted joint venture by American computer manufacturers to make memory chips for their future machines, is now just a memory itself. Its managers pulled the plug on the venture this week before it ever made a single production chip because the industry failed to come up with needed commitments of capital to make the joint venture work. This was supposed to be an American challenge to the growing presence of Japanese firms who now hold a majority share of the memory chip market. And economist and former presidential advisor Elliot Janeway told me this week its collapse is a disgrace.
We should feel contemptuous of the corporate mentality that's been brainwashed by American professors of economics into feeling that the Japanese won fair and square on an open playing field, I'm repeating their baloney, and therefore that it's immoral as well as inefficient to resist or fight back. That would be like, it's unthinkable to me, it would be like having surrendered to Japan the morning after Pearl Harbor.
Janeway says American industry needs to be prodded to take a more aggressive stance to meet the Japanese challenge, and that U.S. Memories was a major missed opportunity. Motorola is bringing out a new computer central processing unit chip to give Apple a new weapon in the war for the power user's dollar. The 68040 chip is expected to power a new generation of Apple Macintosh desktop machines and possibly some Hewlett-Packard models as well. It is said to be more than three times as fast as the rival Intel 486 chip, which is powering the new generation of IBM-compatible machines, but it cannot currently be used in most IBM-compatible machine architectures. It is expected to give Apple a new entry in the high-end workstation market. Apple says it will introduce machines based on the chip as soon as production-level quantities are available, but that's not expected until sometime next year. MacWeek editor and Soundbites contributing commentator Dan Ruby has learned that a new Macintosh machine is on the horizon even before this new chip is phased in. He tells us it will be called the 2XI and could see rollout as early as March 19th. It will have a 33 megahertz clock speed, making it the fastest machine in the Mac line. He'll have more on it and on Apple's current troubles in his commentary later in the program today. Speaking of Apple, they say an anemic fiscal first quarter earnings picture off more than 11% from a year ago will cause the company to go on a fresh cost-cutting drive. No layoffs have been announced yet, but pay hikes are being delayed, company cars and executive perks are being pared, and some industry observers say Apple's first job cut since 1985 are coming soon. Wall Street analysts say cost-cutting may not be enough, however. The consensus, according to the Wall Street Journal, is that Apple needs new low-end machines to replace the aging Mac Plus and technologically ancient Apple II series, which in its essentials dates back to 1977. It was a bug in key computer software that caused the national AT&T long-distance phone system to crash last Monday night. Ma Bell says the outage, which lasted most of the evening, affected about 20% of its normal calling volume starting about mid-afternoon in the east. Both regular and 800 numbers were affected. It was not sabotage, according to AT&T. Well, Apple Macintosh users have been waiting since 1987 for the promised Mac version of the popular Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet, and the company says they're going to have to wait still longer. Expected release date for 1-2-3 for the Mac, possibly 1991. Meanwhile, Lotus is coming out this week with versions of 1-2-3 for OS 2, Unix, Digital Vax, and IBM mainframe applications. And that's this week's Computer News. Listening to Soundbites on WXXI 1370. One of our most popular features is the monthly commentary by computer expert and essayist Nick Francesco. Well, he's got the ability to entertain and amuse while at the same time clarifying some tough issues facing users at every level. He's going to be spending a longer time with us today and be taking your calls at 263-WXXI, that is 263-9994. As we get a piece of Nick Francesco's mind. Nick, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely my pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Now, Nick, what's bugging you most right now? And pardon the pun about bugs.
Yeah, we were just talking about bugs and viruses and things like that. A lot of interesting things going on in the computer field nowadays. One of the things that bugs me most is something we were talking about a little earlier, the lack of... I guess I don't quite know how to put this. The fact that you've got a lot of people out there writing software that assumes they get the whole 640K. We were talking about in the old days of CPM machines that were a maximum of 64K, you could run all of WordStar. WordStar ran in 64K, and you could run your document in there at the same time. When the IBM first came out, the system had 64K in it. WordStar ran great. The latest versions of WordStar say you need a lot more than 64K in order to run. Part of that problem, and the same thing, of course, is true of DBase, which originally ran great on an Osborne 1 in 64K, any CPM system in 64K. When it first came out on the IBM, it ran in 64K. A lot of that has to do, of course, with new features, but a lot of it also has to do with the fact that in the early days, programs were hand-coded. You wrote them in assembler, and you essentially hand-assembled them. You wrote tight, fast, small code. Nowadays, everybody writes in C or whatever your language of choice is, and I love C. I don't want a bunch of people calling up saying, you're down on C, you hate C. I love C. I think it's a great language. I use it myself. But if you're doing a large production thing, you're going to end up with lots of huge code. Even the optimizing compilers don't give you the same kind of tight, fast code that you would get in a hand-assembled environment. So you find that Lotus 1-2-3, for example, says, well, I want the whole 640K. Well, fine. And WordStar or WordPerfect says, well, I want the whole 640K. Well, fine. Then you get something like Windows, which says, well, I want 400K, and you can have the rest. Well, now I can't run Lotus under Windows.
Now, wait a minute. If you've got something like an XT or something with 640K, that doesn't leave you an awful lot of room if you're running Windows for anything else.
Well, it leaves you almost exactly no room.
Yeah.
So now you're in the situation where multi-megabytes of memory are required to run not only the operating system, but also everything else that goes along with it. A lot of people say, well, the problem is, of course, with a company like Microsoft. Well, that's not true. I mean, I'm kind of a Bill Gates basher, I admit that, but it's not really their fault. For example, on an Apple, when the Macintosh first came out, the whole memory of the system was 128K. But it did Windows, it did all of that neat stuff, icons and all that. And it does a lot more than Windows does today. Theoretically, 3.0 will do some of this, but it does a lot more than that. The problem, of course, is that the Macintosh was designed from the ground up to be a graphical engine. There was an additional 128K of ROM, which was hand-coded, which was very tight, very small, very sexy code that did all of the graphical stuff. And on top of that, you didn't have to do much. You wanted to make a window, you made a call, a window happened. You know, you wanted to create an icon, you made a call, you told it what the icon looked like, an icon happened. On the IBM world, it was designed originally to be a glass teletype. In other words, the same stuff you used to get on a teletype, line after line after line of nothing but text, you also got on a screen.
But okay. It did a great job of crunching numbers.
But it did a great job of crunching numbers, only crunching numbers isn't enough anymore. Everybody has to have a graphical interface. And Elaine, I apologize, my wife hates the term graphical interface, but fine. Everybody wants one of those. Well, so on the IBM, you kind of have to kludge it on top of everything else. I love the early versions of Windows, which said, yes, we're a graphical interface, but what you got was a window with the same old list of file names in it. That's not a graphical interface, that's a window with text in it, but fine. They're getting a lot better with that sort of thing, but rather than being designed from the ground up, they have to put all of that stuff into your RAM. And they're not hand-coding any of it, it's all in C or whatever it is so that they can port it back and forth across operating systems, so you don't get real tight, small operating system or application code. You get big stuff.
And you got to buy lots of memory.
Well, right. Then their feeling is, excuse me, I wrote the code. You want to run it, you buy the memory to run it. You know, I did my half, you do your half, and we'll all be together on this.
Which means I got to buy a lot more memory, and these guys are writing a lot sloppier code, which, of course, is probably a lot easier for them to do in the long run because they don't have to think before they write a line of code.
Well, I don't want to go and say that these guys are writing sloppy code.
Although, Adam Osborne does, by the way.
Well, he's in a lot of cases, he's right. I mean, take a look at a lot of the stuff that's out there. You look down in the code, it's pretty sloppy. But, yeah, they are writing sloppy code. But they're also writing, the stuff that they're writing in C is easier to write. It's faster to write. People don't want to learn assembler anymore. It's a pain in the neck to write an assembler. It's easier to write in C. You write one line of C code, and you've got 50 lines of assembler code. Great. The problem is, you could probably do the same thing in 20 lines of assembler code if you did it by hand. And people aren't anymore. And part of that is the economics of the situation. You don't have the time to write hand code stuff in assembler. You get guys who are writing the kind of stuff that Paul's going to talk about. Well, no, he's not going to talk about that today. Shareware and freebie stuff. Actually, a lot of those guys still are writing in assembler because that's what they like. They enjoy getting in there and fiddling with the bits. And if it takes you 6 months to write a little utility, you don't care. The joy is in the writing, not in the selling. When the joy is in the selling, you want to write it awfully quick.
So they're driven by time, and in some cases, some programmers, if they're not driven hard by time and the economic constraints, are a little lazy.
Yes, and also there's the fact that nowadays you write something like DBase, there's no one programmer who writes DBase. I mean, when Wayne Ratliff originally wrote DBase, he wrote it hand-coded, he did it himself, it was all one guy. Now it's like a phalanx of people sitting out there somewhere in Ashton Tate land writing DBase. And these guys have pieces of the code. And there aren't really, project... I mean, this is a whole project, and somebody's got to sit and say, you write this piece, you write this piece, you write this piece, and we'll put it all together, and here are the parameters under which you have to work. And it's tougher to do that under assembler. So if you do it in C, you can say, look, here's your black box, you write this. Here's your black box, you can write that. You can do it under assembler, it's just a lot tougher. And not a lot of people know assembler anymore. Not to the level that you need to know it to write some of this stuff. So a lot of it's getting coded in high-level languages where the tools are available to give you a piece and me a piece, and then somebody else puts it all together for us.
And you hope that it fits together right.
Well, and of course, it always does the first time, no question.
Oh, sure, right. Just like those early 1960s Chryslers that were designed by committee and looked like the guy who designed the front end had no communication at all with the guy who designed the back end.
Well, they were wide enough they probably couldn't hear each other from one end of that car to the other, I'll tell you that.
But anyway, I mean, you look at something like that, it sounds like just a recipe for bugs, a recipe for mess-ups. That's one thing I'm curious of our audience about at 263-WXXI. If they've got experience of that type, sad experience, bad experience, or whatever experience, lines open right now at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Join us on Soundbites, and we'd like to hear from you. We have Nick Francesco with us talking about, well, admittedly getting some things off his chest today about some aspects of the computer world. He, of course, an expert computer programmer and a frequent contributor to our Soundbites program. We'd like to hear from you as well. Now, you know, something else. I've been thinking about it. We've been talking about this power battle. I want to ask you quickly before we go to the phones right now about the big battle, the escalating power wars. Again, it's kind of like the horsepower race in the automobile industry 30 years ago, where everybody was talking about how big a V8 they could cram under the hood. It feels like the computer equivalent of the V8 wars going on right now. And who's ever going to use all that power?
Well, that's an excellent question. I guess the question you have to ask yourself is, what do I do with my computer? If I play a few games, then I need to be fast enough to play the game, but not so fast that I can't win the game. If I do some word processing, a little bit of spreadsheet stuff, I keep my checkbook, my taxes, how much power do you need? It's an interesting point that in most industries today, in most office environments today, the theory is that the secretary gets a low-end machine because he or she just does word processing, and the executive gets the high-end machine because he or she is a management person. The fact is, that should be reversed. Most management people do one, maybe two things at a time. The secretarial person, however, is completely interrupt-driven. He or she is sitting there doing some word processing. The boss comes up, calls up and says, where are the figures for this? Where is this? Where is the other thing? Call such and so. Find out this. What's my itinerary for tomorrow? This is the person who needs 5, 6, 10, 15 sessions to get it all done. So it's not really where you stand in an organization or how much power you wield. It's how much power you need to do the job you do. And if what you do is one thing at a time, you don't need a fast machine. An XT with 600, and this is, of course, speaks directly to you, an XT with 640K and a 40 meg hard drive is a lot of computer, depending on your application.
So, I don't need much for my own personal use, any more than I've got. But somebody who's running an office, who's the office manager and having to handle all kinds of different things at once, he or she might need a lot more machine.
Oh, yeah. The more you do, the more you need to do your job. It's like being a carpenter. You have a thing that you do. You put up drywall. You need a few tools. You're going to build a whole house by yourself. You need a lot of tools. So that's where that comes from. You need to understand what your job is before you can figure out what tool you need to do the job.
And speaking of which, our job is to answer your questions. We've got some calls waiting on the line at 263-WXXI. Wait no longer. Good afternoon. You're on the air with us.
Hi. I'd like to first say I completely agree with Nick's point about picking the appropriate tool. But secondly, I'd like to ask, why does the fact that programs take up so much more memory bug you as much as it does, Nick? Because, as you say, for the low-end user, needs to use one package. They don't have to worry about for the high-end user that wants a graphical interface like Windows or OS 2. You do need the RAM and you do need to pay for it, but supposedly you're going to get it back in higher productivity. So why is there any conflict? And also, I think your point about code being written in C now so it can be ported across environments is probably the most important point you made. Because you do need, as a company, you need to be able to write for several different environments to pay off the economies of scale involved in today's software.
Well, yes, absolutely. I must say, this is obviously a brilliant caller. He agrees with me. But in general, you're right. And the economies of the marketplace are such that you kind of have to write in a portable language, whether it's C or Pascal or Forth or whatever, you know, the language that most floats your boat is. These days, you can find C compilers almost everywhere, and you can get some standards across so that you can write one piece of code that's portable. So yes, I can understand why that is. But why is there conflict? Well, this is probably a personal bug of my own. I happen to be a power user on a beer budget. Okay? I want all of that power. I want to be able to do 5 and 6 and 10 and 20 things at once. The problem is you get spoiled. At work, I have a very powerful machine. I run OS 2. I do 50 things at once. I need to do 50 things at once. I could do another 50 things at once if I had more memory and more power. At home, I only can do one thing at a time. Most of the time, I am only doing one thing at a time. But I would like to be able, I mean, you get used to 8 hours a day switching and grabbing something else. Now at home, I hit that Alt-Escape key, nothing happens. I'm ticked off. I'd love to be able to afford more power, the ability to do more things, but I can't afford it. And it would be real nice if the computer industry could help me afford it by writing smaller applications. Not less powerful applications, just smaller.
I don't think that's ever going to happen. I think the cure for you is to convince your boss to get you a high-end portable machine. Then you can have the same at home and as at work.
Good luck. Let me give you his name and number. And if the next 200 callers would also call him up and ask him, I'm sure that we'd have something going.
And let me ask you one final question. I'll get off the line. Speaking of portables, when do you think the Compact will have a high-end 386 out on the market?
Ooh, excellent question. My crystal ball is just a tad cloudy at the moment. I think it's going to depend on the results of this last quarter. If the machines that they have out now are still selling as well as they did the quarter before, they have no real economic need to bring out more machines. If, in fact, they feel that somebody else is sneaking up behind them, or the machines that they're currently selling are not selling as well as they'd like to, then they'll do the marketplace a favor and bring out something else. That's true of almost any company. Until you get to the point where the system that you're selling isn't making as much money as you want it to make, you're not going to bring out something else. That, in fact, is Apple's whole situation. Why do we still have a Mac Plus that's like 200-year-old technology sitting out there? People are buying Mac Pluses. I own a Mac Plus. I love my Mac Plus. But they're still out there mainly because people will still buy them. If people were all sit down one day and call up John Sculley and say, John, we're done with the Mac Plus. We're bored. Old technology. Get rid of it. Put something new in its place. Nobody bought them. He'd stop selling them and he'd put something else in its place.
Do you think that's what's happening with the price on the Mac Portable?
Yeah, I definitely think so. The Mac Portable is a real hot idea at a real cold price. And I think what you're going to find is that Apple, of course, has owned the market for forever. I mean, there are no Mac clones. Apple did something. When IBM first came out with the PC, the idea was, well, they figured if they were going to sell 15,000 of them at most over 5 years, that would be a lot. So they took industry standard components off the shelf and cobbled together a computer and sent it out the door. Great. Apple said, we're going to make everything proprietary. So on the IBM end, clone makers can go to those same shelves and pick up those same components and build those same machines. On the IBM side, you can't buy Mac ROMs. So Macs come from Apple. IBM clones come from everybody. So the price of the IBM clone has been driven down. Apple continues to maintain their high price because there is no competition. Now, of course, that's going to change, theoretically, according to Billy Boy, with the new version of Windows and with OS 2 and like all that stuff. Who knows? But the point is, as long as they can continue to maintain the high price and continue to sell systems at that price, there is absolutely no need for them to put out a new machine.
Billy Boy, your favorite teenage billionaire?
That's right. Bill Gates.
Having seen all those products, he may be right. Thanks very much, gentlemen. I won't tie up your phone anymore.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to another call right now, 263-WXXI. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I got a couple of quick comments and a question. First off, Nick, I'll sign the petition for your portable also.
Okay, I got two.
and going back to the question of programs taking up as little RAM as possible, I know I don't do a whole lot of multitasking, but I would like to be able to do two things at once sometimes. And with 640K these days, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Very few programs allow you to even do two things at once. That would be nice.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, take a look at the simple fact of having your word processor, a Sidekick phone directory, and a print queue in your machine all at once.
can't do it.
You have to be real careful with the word processor you pick in order to run those three things. So I'm not asking for a lot. I don't want to run the entire nation, although, of course, I would do a brilliant job at it, but I don't want to run the entire nation. I just want to do three things at once.
Right. And the question, Nick, is I've heard you refer to yourself as a PC guru. Bob likes to throw that term around, too. I'm wondering what that is. How do you get certified PC guru status? Is there a school for it?
I run a school. Funny you should mention that. I do run a school. Those of you who are interested can take the test. You'll find the matchbooks in almost any vending machine. Please feel free to write in. The test is pretty simple. Draw this PC, and I'll be glad to give you PC guru status of your own.
Okay, thanks.
And here, sure. I thought I was the only guy in town who could confer that status officially. Now, gee, you know, you've busted my balloon completely. 263-WXXI is our number. Sound bites for the program. I'm Bob Smith, and we are talking with Nick Francesco about whatever happens to be on your mind and what certainly is on his mind as far as all of us who are in the world of personal computing. 263-WXXI. You talked about OS2 a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
You use it at work. I heard all kinds of different things about it, ranging from it's the saving of mankind and the second coming of computer whatever, computer nirvana, all the way to don't bother with it. It's just another way to get your money. You don't need it. Just use your DOS. Buy Windows if you want to have something nice and fancy for interface. Forget about it. You don't need it. Because Bill Gates makes money either way because he supplies everybody. But
I like OS2. I shouldn't say that. That's going to drop a lot of socks around town. I actually enjoy OS2. The ability to do that multitasking, the ability to, in a work environment, to say, okay, I've got some 35 purchase orders that need to go out, and I need to do all this calculation on the one hand, plus I'm trying to write the cover letter for those on the other hand, plus I'm trying to get my electronic mail sent and things like that. The ability to say, all right, Lotus, go off and start recalculating these 35 purchase orders, and at the same time upload some or download some calendar information so I know what the heck I'm doing tomorrow, and at the same time I'm going to start writing that letter, that's a time saver. For me and my job, that's a real time saver. So it's nice to have that capability.
At home?
Do I need it? No.
Okay, so I don't need this at home, but I might conceivably need it at work if I've got a complex job.
Yeah, again, you have to look at your workflow. If you really do one thing at a time, I don't know of a job in America that does one thing at a time, but if you do only one thing at a time, then you don't really need multitasking. But if you find yourself constantly with your calendar on your desk and something else and two or three things, and you're calculating this while you're writing that, it's not a bad idea to have that capability.
So tell your boss to buy it for you.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Tell your boss, look, I have to have this in order to do the work you want me to do.
Okay, boss, are you listening? But I wonder something else, too, and that gets to the whole issue of hardware, too, and that is how much you have to have for work as opposed to how much you have to have at home, because the thing is, I know some people who have bought some very high-power machines for their home use.
Mm-hmm.
I know a man who happens to be the editor of a major computer magazine who went out and spent some serious bucks on a very high-power 386 chip machine. Now, that's not quite the Mi Plus Ultra anymore, but for practically available machines in most computer stores, that's as powerful as it gets. So he's got 33 megahertz speed, which is as fast as it gets, and he really went out and did it up brown. I don't need to do that, do I?
No, probably not. Again, look at your workflow. Do you sit around and do one thing at a time? You write a letter to your Aunt May, and then you sit down and figure out your checkbook, and then you play a game. If you do one thing at a time, it's all you need to do.
Great. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Nick, I believe you used to program in Forth. Is that correct?
It's absolutely correct.
Given the Macintosh's new system coming on the scene and your interest in keeping things all bubbling at once, do you see an option for System 7 and or 4th getting us anywhere new in the future with more memory?
For those of you who don't know much about Forth, it's another programming language, and it generally, depending on a compiler again, but it generally writes pretty tight, small code. If you've got any compiler, whether it be Forth or C or whatever, that generates nice, tight code, and you can write to the multitasking hooks that are in System 7, now don't forget, you're not going to see the compilers to write to System 7 until System 7 is actually out in the market.
Right.
So there's going to be a lag. But once you see those, I think you're going to find that in products like Mac Forth and a couple of others that have kept up with the industry, you'll be able to do a lot of sexy stuff you can't do today.
I see. What's your favorite language on the Mac?
Oh, my goodness. I'd have to say Mac Forth, although Lightspeed C is real close. Actually, not only do I like Lightspeed C, I like their ad. They have a great ad that says, make mistakes faster.
Okay, well, on that note, I say thank you to Nick Francesco. You're listening to Soundbites on WXXI 1370.